Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. We just concluded that conversation with Ted Kober, author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for March called Confession and Forgiveness. I would like you to remember to place your order for this book this week. It's a great resource for the season of Lent that we find ourselves in. I'd also remind Cynthia from the last hour, she was a caller, and keeping a promise, I need to ask her to call us back so that I can send her a free copy of our Issues Etc. book of the month for March called Confession and Forgiveness. That's Cynthia. She was a caller earlier in the hour. You can order the book. For those of you who aren't getting it free from me today, you can order it online if you like. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section of the website, you'll find information on this book, issuesetc.org. You can also call Concordia Publishing House during regular business hours. You'll have to do it tomorrow because they're closed up for the day at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. When you call or when you write, ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for March called Confession and Forgiveness. The book is only $9.99. 1-800-325-3040. We're joined for the remainder of the program for the rest of the hour by General Jack Vesey. He's a former chairman for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he is also the chairman of the National Cabinet for the Sake of the Church campaign for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. General Vesey, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. What is your general reaction to the progress of the war in Iraq so far?
The commanders on the ground say it's going the way they planned, and if it's going the way they planned, that's fine.
Are you surprised by the rapid movement toward what appears to be the major objective, and that is the city of Iraq? It has only been 5 days, or 6 days today.
No, I'm not really. I think that's clearly a major part of the plan.
You're a veteran of several wars, having been on the ground in several of them. Does this strike you as a different kind of war than the United States has waged up to this point in its history?
Well, it's different in many ways, but some of the fundamental parts of it are the same. when you get down to the fights of the infantrymen, most wars are pretty much alike. They change in terms of technology and weapons and support that the infantryman has, but the infantryman's war is essentially unchanged. I would say the major difference is for the whole world. We are watching it, it's almost like watching the Super Bowl or something, because there are all sorts of correspondence from television, newspapers, radio, whatever you have, all over the battlefield. We have this marvelous God-given invention of cheap transistors that have enabled this communications revolution, where we can sit here and have a correspondent with a tank company out there broadcasting live pictures. I'm sort of ambivalent about all that. But it's here, and I really think that's the major change. That is, everybody in the world that has access to a television or a radio has the opportunity to know what's going on almost minute by minute, at least with slices of the war. Now, for most of us, like none of us other than the commanders, the major commanders, and the president, the secretary of defense, we'll have the opportunity to see the whole picture. But nevertheless, we're seeing war as we've never seen it before. You know, I first went to war in the fall of 1942. I suspect it was days before people in the United States had any idea of what was happening to us on the ground, what we were doing. The same was true in subsequent wars, although the communications got faster and more refined all along. But this has been a revolution since the last Gulf War. It remarkably changed.
I heard a journalist yesterday evening comment. He was one who was covering the takeoffs and the landings of all the air sorties that are being launched, especially for close air support for the troops as they close in on Baghdad. And this journalist said, interestingly enough, he says, we are finding out as journalists, we're talking to these pilots as they step out of their airplanes, and we're finding out how the sortie went even before their commanding officers find out, or before the people who are running the war find out. You mentioned an ambivalent feeling about this. Does that present a problem?
Well, you know, I was reared in the generation when security, operational security, was a principle of war. That is to say, you did your best to hide your intentions and your next actions from your enemy. Now we're seeing at least ostensibly part of it displayed on the television, and certainly we can be sure that the enemy is watching the television. Now maybe it's part of a deception plan, but in answer to your question, I think the commanders already know what happened on the sorties. The communications between the fighter planes and the ground is superb. But as a matter of fact, the people on the ground can see whether or not the target has been hit as well as perhaps even better than the pilot. But you're right, the reporters are there talking to them before they get into the debriefing room.
The Secretary of State, Colin Powell, was interviewed by Fox News on Monday, and he had to say this in answer to the whole issue of watching the war on television, especially watching it in real time and watching it in kind of these slices, as you said. He says, people have to understand this isn't a video game. It's war. It's a real war. What do you think the Secretary of State meant to say by this?
Well, I think he meant to say what I tried to imply about my ambivalence about this is that with these cameras out there, we're likely to see some terrible things. And maybe that's not all bad. Maybe we'll have a better understanding. You know, most of the people get their idea of what war is like by watching war movies, and most of the war movies don't even touch the nastiness of war. So far, this one hasn't been particularly nasty. It's nasty enough for those soldiers and Marines and airmen who've been killed or captured, but the hard part is yet to come, I would say.
General, you had opportunity, I believe in 1988, to lead a delegation, if I'm not mistaken, to Vietnam to inquire about, long after the fact, of course, about the status of soldiers who were missing in action. We have soldiers who have now been captured who are prisoners of war. I don't know, with the current news, we might have some more MIAs as well in the Iraqi war. Give us your perspective on the capture and the holding of our soldiers as prisoners of war by the Iraqis.
Well, it will happen. That is to say, we will have some people captured. And as our leaders have made it clear, is that we will abide by the Geneva Convention, and we expect them to abide by the Geneva Convention. And in the last major wars that we have fought, the enemies have not abided by the Geneva Convention. Certainly we don't like to have our people captured, but it will happen.
It comes as a surprise to us who are watching this in the soundbite medium of television and radio. Does it come as a surprise to those who are actually on the ground? I know it's a shock to them. It's not wanted. But do they, you say it's going to happen, do they expect it as well to happen, the soldiers in the
air? Well, I'm sure that every single commander and every single soldier is going to do everything he can in his power to keep from being surprised, and hence either killed, wounded, or captured. But you have to recognize that the people on the other side are doing everything in they can in their power to surprise and inflict harm on our people. So, it is it's part of the training that we give our people is superb. They're trained to protect themselves as best they can. But the fact of the matter is they're all fallible, sinful human people like you and me. Mistakes will be made. People will take wrong turns. People will misread maps. The language is a difficult thing to wrestle with. Nicholas Murray Butler once said the first evidence of an education is mastery of the mother tongue. And I tell people I've seen more things screwed up on the battlefield and in the Pentagon because of a failure to master the mother tongue, that is, to speak clearly, concisely, and understandably about what is to be done and what's to happen. So mistakes will be made.
We're talking with General Jack Vesey. He's former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. If you have a question or a comment for General Vesey, you can give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Calling from her car, Sheila is on the line. Sheila, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor. I have a question to place. How does this fact that everything is just out there step by step and war affect the national security, and are we in danger of totally desensitizing everyone to the horrors of war from this constant barrage of information?
Thank you very much, Sheila. It's an excellent question. Let's go to our second question first, if we could. General, the danger of desensitizing people to the horrors of war because we're seeing it in real time in some cases?
Well, I don't know. We will find out. It rubs me the wrong way. It's almost like watching the Super Bowl, and you expect to see the woman reporter grab the coach on his way to the locker room or something like that. But I think the Defense Department has probably made the right decision doing it the way they're doing it. That is, let the people see for live and in action that it's difficult. It's oftentimes disconnected. And it looks like things are not running right. And I'm sure that we will see pictures of wounded fights going on, so maybe it'll spread an understanding of both the dangers and the confusion of war. I'm not sure. I just don't know the answer to that question. I guess we'll have to wait until after it's all over and find out.
Well, a concern that you've already expressed, which was also part of the first question that Sheila asked about, was the danger of giving the enemy information, unintentionally, of course, but giving the enemy information that they could use against us because we are covering these things, and they've got televisions, and they've got the ability to receive our signals just as well.
Yeah, and I'm sure that that our commanders understand that, and they're trying their best to make sure that that doesn't endanger our troops, but it is a worrisome.
There's been a lot of talk in the last 2 days about the rules of war, in particular with regard to these fake surrenders that some of the Republican Guard, or at least it appears to be in Republican Guard mixed in among civilians, have been engaging in. Usually ends with an ambush, with a few dead, and I'd hate to be in the position of the man on the ground trying to figure out who's surrendering and who's just trying to fake us out. What do the rules of war, if they have anything to say about that kind of a situation?
You can't pose as a civilian and fight as a soldier. So the people who do that are violating the rules of war. But nevertheless, that doesn't help the forces on the ground. You can't hold up the sign and say you're not playing by the rules. There's nobody in a striped shirt out there to referee it. It's a situation you have to face on the ground. And you'll see, if you read the history books, nations that have been confronted with ununiformed, non-uniformed forces before and have taken serious actions against them. They've later been tried for war crimes for taking those actions. So it's a difficult situation for the commanders on the ground. They'll just have to deal with it.
Something else the American public has been seeing via the media with regard to the war is the youth of our troops. I think people know this in the back of their minds, but to see how young these men and women actually are, especially how young they look, some of them barely out of high school, should this be cause for concern? Is this unusual in the military?
No. I think I was 19 when I got shot at the first time, and the average age of the armed forces is about 23 or 24. So it's youthful activity, and it has always been that way. I think even now it is not so much so as it was in times past. It's been more so in times past. But nowadays, with the new technology and with the volunteer force in the United States, we've found that keeping people around longer has value. So you'll find people in infantry units and tank units that are now in their 30s and on up into their 40s, as a matter of fact, in some cases. But it's a youthful business. Has always been that way. As a matter of fact, one of the last questioner asked about the horrors, or suggested about the horrors of war. If you ever want an experience to tell you about how horrible war is, go through one of the national battlefield monument cemeteries. Go to the one at Normandy and just look at those crosses and stars of David. Then get down there and look at the birth date and the death date. And you'll understand why Luther was convinced that wars are the work of the devil.
With regard to the two greatest fears that I think most people here in America now have with regard to our troops there in Iraq, chemical weapons, biological weapons, those weapons of mass destruction, as they've been kind of called in one under one category, and urban warfare that it appears we'll eventually, sooner or later, have to engage in there around in Baghdad, and we already have in other Iraqi cities. Does that change the complexion here? Is this anything new for the American fighting forces?
No, certainly urban warfare is not new. Certainly in every war that I was in, we were engaged in urban warfare at some time or another, and it's difficult business, and certainly with a fellow like Saddam Hussein, who uses his own civilian population as a cover for his armed forces, it'll make it more difficult for our people. I think we will be very smart about that. At least that's my prayer, that we do not get ourselves involved in a difficult urban situation, that we use new and modern techniques and technology. Concerning the weapons of mass destruction, in the past, World War I gas was used. Both sides used it. Neither side got an advantage from it. In World War II, both sides had it, but both sides recognized that that unless you could win the war with it quickly, it just became an inconvenience for both sides. So it wasn't used. The Germans were very advanced in, with their chemical warfare before World War II, and we knew that, but we caught up, and it was never used on the battlefield against us, and certainly we didn't use it. Now, when we have renounced chemical warfare, and you give a little bit of an advantage to the other side if he can use it, because you can't retaliate with chemical weapons and make it as uncomfortable for him as it is for you to fight in protective gear. However, there's great danger in using chemicals on the battlefield because, by and large, it's a subject, it's a function of which way the wind blows, and the wind may change and blow your own chemicals back to you. So even the fellow who uses them, knowing that the other side has no capability of retaliating with chemical weapons, it's still a great danger for him. So we'll see. I think I'm satisfied that that our commanders will have thought of a very punishing response to the use of weapons of mass destruction, and I hope the other side recognizes that, that that's the case and won't use them.
Aside from their apparent possession of and willingness to use chemical biological weapons, what is your assessment of the Iraqi fighting forces, in particular those that seem to be drawing the ring around Baghdad at this point?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm well qualified to answer that question, but certainly we know that there are gradations in the capabilities of the fighting forces. And we know that the bulk of the people in Iraq are not necessarily favorable toward Saddam Hussein and his inner clique, particularly the Shiites in the southeast. And yet they make the majority of the, make up the majority of the population, and his army is a a drafted army, so the bulk of his army is made up of people who don't necessarily agree with him. So that's a bit of a problem for him, and we've seen perhaps some of that in some of the surrenders that have already taken place. On the other hand, that won't be true of his Republican Guards and his inner, I've forgotten what it's called, but he's got an inner circle of even more important than the general Republican Guards, so and they get the best equipment and probably the best training.
Let's take a break here, General. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. General Jack Vesey, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is our guest. He's also chairman of the National Cabinet. For the sake of the church campaign for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, if you have a question or a comment on the war with Iraq, you can call us during this break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The courts of justice are there to protect our rights and to right the wrongs that occur between men. Should Christians take one another to court? What's the difference between conflict resolution and Christian reconciliation? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March is called Confession and Forgiveness by Ted Kober. You can order the book online by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book, and you can even read an excerpt. issuesetc.org. Or order by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. Now, when you call, be sure to ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, Confession and Forgiveness, 1-800-325-3040, weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040.
Charles Darwin. Now, he was a racist.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the bestseller, The Lie Evolution. Well, Ken, didn't Darwin write that certain Indians in South America were still in the monkey stage of evolution?
Well, it's a sad fact of history that Darwin wanted to convince people that there was hardly any difference at all between men and monkeys. During his famous trip on the ship, the Beagle, he described some South American Indians as cannibals who are almost as much beast as men. Now, this statement convinced many people of his day that these Indians were at one of the lowest stages of evolution. No wonder terrible racist attitudes and horrible actions resulted towards these people. But the truth of the matter is that Darwin hardly saw an Indian at all. He couldn't even speak one word of their language. Not only that, these particular Indians were not even cannibals, and they actually believed in one supreme being to whom they prayed with confidence. And they also had principles of morality that were very high. Ironically, they regarded the white people who exploited them as morally inferior. See, people need to wake up and realize that Darwinian evolution, taught throughout public education systems, is an ardently racist philosophy. The correct view of man comes from God's word in Genesis, of course.
What's the correct view of whether there's life in outer space? The Bible can shed light on this fascinating question. Ken Ham looks at what Scripture and science say about life in outer space in a new booklet, available free on our website at AnswersRadio.com.
It's 5:31. We'll continue with Issues, etc. in about 2 minutes. Again, General Jack Vesey. It's Todd's guest. AMA 50K FUO weather, partly cloudy overnight, 38 for the low, partly cloudy tomorrow with a high of 62. Right now it is cloudy in St. Louis and 52. In traffic, northbound 270 is heavy in the right lanes, north of Dorset to the westbound 70 exits. Westbound 70 at the airport, slow traffic, then busy from Earth City across the Blanchet Bridge. Slow in the right lane at 94 and a little slow at Spencer's out to Mid Rivers. Eastbound 270 is heavy and slow from Missouri Bottom Road to 170. Eastbound 40 at Compton, slow traffic out to the Poplar Street Bridge, and northbound 55 lines up in the right lane from 44 out to the Poplar Street Bridge.
On Thursday's Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO, join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers, will talk with Stephen Salengut, the author of The Brainwashing of the American Investor. Johnny McCoy joins us. Her latest book is called Frugal Families, Making the Most of Your Hard-Earned Money. It begins at 11:05 Thursday, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our guest for the remainder of the program for the next 25 minutes is General Jack Vesey, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. If you have a question or comment on the war with Iraq, you can call us now and in the next 25 minutes, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you're a car phone caller, a first-time caller, or an internet caller, we give you top priority in the list of callers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. General Vesey, what does the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff do?
Well, his duties are defined in the law. He is the principal military advisor to the President, the Secretary of Defense, and the National Security Council. He also acts as the President's agent in passing orders to the commanders of the unified and specified commands, who are the command, like General Franks, as you see on television. He's the commander of Central Command. The president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and his number one civilian agent is the Secretary of Defense. So the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the president and the Secretary of Defense are sort of the triumvirate in command of the armed forces. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs is the military agent of the president and the secretary. He has a staff. He provides the strategic plans and strategic direction for the armed forces, the logistic plans to support those. He provides the policies and practices for joint training of the armed forces, that is to have the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps trained together so that they can work together on in major operations such as the one going on in Iraq, and he supervises the upper level education system for the officers at the National War College, the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, and the Joint Staff College.
And how many years did you serve as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff?
I served a little over 3 years. I was appointed for two-year terms, but I had promised my wife that I would get her back to Minnesota before the first snow in the fall of 85.
What was it like serving under President Reagan?
It was certainly an honor and in many ways a joy. When President Reagan was running for president, and I thought that the American people deserved a better choice than a choice between a peanut farmer from Georgia and an ex movie star, but. After serving with both of those people, I understand why we have a democratic system, and our leaders come from a remarkable set of backgrounds. President Reagan was a man of great vision. He had a great affection for the armed forces, but he also listened carefully to advice. He was a good commander-in-chief. I often remind people of what Salvador de Madariaga said, a great Spanish philosopher. He said, our eyes must be idealistic, but our feet must be realistic. We must keep our eye on the ultimate objective, but recognize that we walk there one step at a time. And President Reagan never lost sight of the ultimate objective, but he also recognized that he had to take individual steps to get there.
You also serve as the chairman for the National Cabinet on a campaign for the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod called For the Sake of the Church. What is this?
I just was about to tell you that we had to talk about For the Sake of the Church. For the Sake of the Church is a wonderful effort to double the number of Lutheran Church Missouri Synod students in our wonderful 10 college and university Concordia University system. And a concomitant part of that is to add $400 million to the endowment, to the collective endowment for all the schools, to help those students get out of school debt-free, with the expectation that many may choose to go into church work, either go on to the seminary to become pastors or go into our wonderful parochial school system or the DCEs in congregations or whatever it happens to be. Those are the goals. To refresh the leadership of this church body so that it can carry the Lord's wonderful message to the, as Jesus told us, to the ends of the earth.
Well, as someone who came through the Lutheran parochial school system from kindergarten through a Lutheran high school, through a Lutheran teacher's college, as they called it when I went through, and then on to seminary and beyond, and didn't do it debt-free, General, I thank you for your work, and I hope you keep it up. Folks, it's called For the Sake of the Church, and there's a website you can visit to find out more. It's SAKE, that's SAKE.LCMS.org, SAKE.LCMS.org. Also, a toll-free telephone number, 1-800-248-1930, extension 1054. That's 1-800-248-1930, extension 1054.
I would just urge your listeners that haven't already looked into it to look into this. This is a wonderful way to strengthen the church, not only through the opportunity to provide more church workers, but to strengthen parishes by having Christians with a Christian university education go into the law or medicine or business or whatever it happens to be. The church will be stronger no matter what field of work our Concordia graduates go into.
Our guest is General Jack Vesey. He's a former chairman for the Joint Chiefs of Staff and chairman for the National Cabinet of a campaign for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod called For the Sake of the Church. Our phone numbers, if you have a question on the war with Iraq, for the general, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. General, let's talk a bit about public opinion and war. That seems to be an obsession, the daily obsession of what we think about the war, whether or not we're behind it, whether or not it's going fast enough or being done well enough. How big of a factor is the public opinion of the American people when America goes to war?
Well, we talked about presidents making decisions. That is a job of enormous responsibility, and particularly in ordering troops into combat. The presidents have to weigh all sorts of things, but among the things they have to weigh is public opinion. In this wonderful country of ours, the government is not somebody else. It's not somebody apart from us as it is in Iraq. It's we the people. We hold these truths to be self-evident. We establish this Constitution. We elect representatives. The president can't do a thing. He can't spend a penny that's not authorized and appropriated by the Congress, the other people that we elect directly. So all of that's a consideration. The president has to have the support of the American people to do whatever he's going to do. And certainly, support for war in this country has always been chancy. In the fall of 1941, just less than 2 months before Pearl Harbor, the draft was continued by one vote in the Congress. So we shouldn't be surprised that there are people who oppose what the president is doing. But it's something that the president has to take into consideration. He has to work to get the support of the people.
I was listening recently to a radio program that was highlighting kind of the long history in American civic life of protest, of war. It appears that virtually every war we have waged as a nation, and even before the nation, the American Revolution, had its protesters, even though they wouldn't have called themselves that in those days. Is this true?
Yes, it's true, and I say thank God for it.
Does it, some would say it would dissolve the resolve of our troops if protests were too loud or too widespread?
Well, the troops, having fought in a war that was in the Vietnam War and have it where the protests were violent and strong, and almost vicious toward the people that we the people had sent off to fight the war, it certainly had an effect on morale there.
And yet, you say you thank God for the long history.
We have the opportunity to protest. That we have the freedom to do that, to express our opinion, but we ought to do it thoughtfully. When I think of just watching, I've got the television on here, and I'm watching the news without sound, which, as I talk to you, which may be the best way to do it. But I was seeing pictures of protesters being dragged away from downtown Minneapolis today. And I wonder if these protesters, and many of them are sort of organized protesters, people who protest against everything, and others are people who have fought through this particular issue and a lot of protests through this one. But I wonder if we would have had this war had all the protesters organized and protested against Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction and the violence he inflicted on his own people. I wonder if he hasn't drawn heart from those protests, and perhaps that's why we're in the war that we're in. I don't know the answer to that question, but it's a question. If you're going to protest the actions of your own government, you ought to ask, what's the effect on the enemies of your country?
Let's go to the phones, General, and talk first with Al, who's calling from his car. Al, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Sir, I just wondered if, I don't know a lot, and maybe a lot of people don't know a lot about the General Tommy Franks. And I'd like just a little bit of background or know a little bit about him and how a gentleman as himself gets put in charge of an operation such as this, what his qualifications are, and just how that process is worked along.
Al, thank you for the question.
That's a great question, Al. I don't know Tommy Franks personally myself. I knew of him. He was obviously a very young officer. I left the active military service over 17 years ago. So, but I knew of him and knew about his reputation as a tough fighter. He has both an aviation and a special forces background, and is known as a solid planner and thinker with great concern for the troops that that work for him. He has a marvelous reputation in the armed forces, and obviously the people who chose him and those jobs, the President of the United States chooses the commanders of the Unified and Specified Commands, and he does it based on the recommendations of the Secretary of Defense, and the Secretary gets his recommendations from the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who gets his from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the heads of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and Marine Corps.
How difficult is it, not only within the U.S. military and its command structure, but then outside with armies of other nations that are working together in efforts like this in Iraq, how difficult is it to hold such a coalition, even as they're calling it the Coalition of the Willing, together during a time of war?
Well, you know, the coalition business is formed by politicians. That's the leaders of the country that form the coalitions. But it is the commanders of the various military services that have to work together. In my time, I have I've fought side by side with Algerians, with Indians, from India, that is, from with Poles who are refugees from Poland, Moroccans, New Zealanders, Frenchmen, British troops from the United Kingdom, with Vietnamese forces, with Thai forces, with Laotian forces, with Korean forces. It takes work and understanding on both sides and a common view of what has to be done, and some people who work hard at understanding each other. When I commanded the forces in Korea, it was clear if I was going to command 600,000 Korean troops, I'd better learn to speak their language. So it's tough work, but and particularly everyone trains slightly differently. Fortunately, since World War II, we've had some wonderful alliances that have been continuing alliances. NATO, our partnership with the Koreans, the Japanese, and the Far East. So we know how to work together among the forces of the NATO nations, and Korea, the United States, Japan, and the United States, the Philippines, and the United States. But it takes a lot of work. We send people to their schools, they send people to our schools. It's something that you can't. It's not like a pickup game of touch football out on the field. You have to plan it over years and practice it and look at ways to compensate for the differences in equipment, the differences in communication systems, certainly the differences in languages. It's difficult business, but we've had a lot of practice at it.
Let's talk with Jack, who's calling from his car. Jack, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, General Vesey, it's your friend Jack Science from Illinois. How you doing?
Good. How are you, sir?
I'm doing. First of all, I want to thank you for helping my son with his senior honors paper last Christmas. He got an A-plus in the course. So that was good. So you had a victory there. But I was just wondering, when we go up against these Nebuchadnezzar and Medina divisions, do you think that they're going to use a softening strategy, maybe with the B-52s, carpet bombing, or what do you? What do you think? I'm going to rest off and let you take over here, but they should. They're going to probably do some to interdict them, don't you think?
Thanks, Jack.
That's a great question. I'm sure that General Franks and his troops will make it as difficult for them as they can. They'll find out about the tremendous investment we've made in smart weapons and in smart target finders. In the early days of my fighting, most of the stuff we shot was to whom it may concern. We now shoot at the target generally once and hit it. So that's what will happen to that force.
We have time for one more phone call. Herman calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask General Vesey if at this time in history, in the present, while there is a great action going on in Iraq, there seem to be other terrorist opponents, some of which are terrorist states and some of which are non-states, but organizations all the way from Al-Qaeda that claims a religious motivation to Saddam Hussein, who's really a secular Arab Ba'athist, as well as to an old leftover Stalinist communist like Kim Jong-il and the Colombia drug cartel, which is being aided by the Irish Republican Army. And I think there are military units of the U.S. in action now with the Philippine Army against terrorist insurgents there. Would that be an accurate appraisal? All these groups are not one conspiracy, but they seem to have ways they scratch each other's back.
Herman, thank you for the call. General Vesey.
Yes, you're exactly right, Herman. Certainly, everyone who has some troubles to pick with the United States will use some way or another to take advantage of our involvement in any particular part of the world. And certainly you could see it with Kim Jong-il's posturing in Korea is a good example.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that, this war is in some ways different, but in many ways on the ground for the infantry in particular, war is war. This is going to go the way that many have. There's a tendency for us to think that advancing technology will change the nature of war once and for all. And you've talked about the increased accuracy, of course, of our weapons and our ability to deliver them. But even with the most technologically advanced military in all of its various branches, in the history of the human race, is war still war? Will it ever get to that video game detached stage?
I don't know the answer to that question, what will happen in the future, but certainly it's not there yet. And you often hear news reports of light action here or there. And the fact of the matter is, for the soldiers, sailors, or Marines who were involved in the so-called light action, it was total war at the time of the action. And we should never forget that and keep those young men and women in our prayers.
General Jack Vesey, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, and thanks for helping me say a few words about For the Sake of the Church.
Thank you.
Wonderful program underway in our church body.
And thank you for your service to our country as long as it has been, and your service to our church in that capacity as well. General Jack Vesey is former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's also chairman of the National Cabinet for a campaign for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod called For the Sake of the Church. It's making an effort to get people into and out of the synodical colleges, the colleges of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the university system there, in order not only to train church workers, which is always needful in the church, with the shortage of pastors and teachers and others who serve in congregations all across denominational lines as well, but also for training Christian people to pursue their various vocations outside church work, the doctors and lawyers, whatever vocation God may call them to. That's necessary as well. It's trying to relieve part of the financial burden there so they can come through debt-free, something I wish that I would have had as someone who still pays a bill every month for student loans, but also to equip the church for the future. And it's all ultimately for the purpose that the general mentioned there, that the message of Christ, the message of the cross of Christ, might have free course and be preached to the joy and the edification of God's people and for the good of the world as well, for those who hear that life-giving gospel of Jesus Christ. You want to know something, folks? That's why there's war, too. War's not good. It's not a great thing. It's always something that is an evil, but it's something that God even permits in our world. Why? Not necessarily to remove tyrants. That's a good thing. To bring justice, yes, of course, but ultimately for this purpose, so that the gospel of Christ might be freely preached, so that Christ's cross might be brought to every end of the earth, to every corner of the globe. That's why he even permits something like war. That's the bigger picture on this whole thing happening in Iraq or wherever it may happen in the future. If you'd like to find out more about For the Sake of the Church, you can visit their website. It's sake.lcms.org. That's sake.lcms.org, or you can call them toll-free 1-800-248-1930, extension 1054, 1-800-248-1930, extension 1054. Prayerfully consider supporting For the Sake of the Church, those who are entering church work and those who are being trained by this university system to enter their various vocations. 1-800-248-1930, extension 1034. Tomorrow on the program, Dr. Ken Cherb, our continuing series, we'll talk about myths regarding absolution. I'm Todd Wilkin.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.